When you think about money, if you think like, okay, I've got this like tight grip on money because I still have that like sense of need. I need this. Like I need, like I'm going to be broke. I'm going to be under that bridge if I don't have it. So I'm grasping on as tight as I can, right? Well, okay. Well, maybe the money won't go out of your hands, but it's also really hard for anything to get in there.
Well, hey there, if we have not yet met, my name is Alex Judd. I'm the founder of Path for Growth, and this is the Path for Growth podcast. Now, as a business, we exist to help impact-driven leaders step into who they were created to be so that others benefit and God is glorified. And this podcast is just another iteration of how that mission comes to life. Business owners and business leaders are often plagued by a problem that doesn't seem like a problem. They make a lot of money, and you're like, okay, how on earth is that a problem? Well, you get to this stage where it's like, oh man, this thing's going well. We're making some money. We're providing value to people and the results are good. And then maybe we're even into the stage where we're building wealth. And it's in that situation that leaders often realize, oh my gosh, we have zero strategy or intentional plan for properly managing this wealth. And that's a real issue for anyone that is focused on stewarding responsibly the resources they've been given to multiply impact for the future. And it was kind of in reflecting on that challenge that many leaders face that I was introduced to Jeff Soha. Jeff has been in this world for a long time. It was years ago now that he founded and built ARK Financial, which was a fractional family office firm. And he actually ended up orchestrating a multi-million dollar exit from that organization. And it was just a couple years ago now that he started Soha Capital. And that organization, just like starting from the bare bones, bootstrapping it, has gone from zero to $3 million in annual revenue in just under 2 years. Those results are really remarkable. But what's even more cool about Jeff and his perspective is his passion for serving people by helping them make sure they have the right mindset and heart around the resources they've been given. And then getting really practical about what are just the basic blocking and tackling things that you can do that if you focus on them consistently, it will help you manage your wealth responsibly. And so we're going to break this conversation into two parts. In this part, we're going to focus on the mindset behind wealth building. And then in the second part, which we'll release next week, we're going to focus on five specific pillars of wealth building. And Jeff's going to walk us through really practically how do we put these things into action for ourselves and our organizations. Here's part one of my conversation with Jeff Soha. Well, Jeff, I've really been looking forward to this conversation. Before we jump into the meat of what we're going to talk about, I want to make sure people understand the context of what you're coming from. So I'd love for you to describe a little bit about what it is that you and your team do. And then even beyond that, I'd love to hear a little bit about why you are so personally passionate about the work that y'all do.
Oh, man. Thanks, Alex. So at the core of it, I really want to help people. I really want to serve people. And, you know, how we got to doing what we're doing now, I've always liked math and science. I ended up with an engineering degree in school, undergrad, you know. So we take somewhat of an engineering process to helping people. Generally, the people that we help are founders, entrepreneurs, like first generation kind of creators. And there's really five big key areas that I find that is needed in their financial life. The first one being cash flow. We've got to get super organized around that. Second being investing, like what do we do with the resources we're creating? Third is risk management. How do we protect everything and not go backwards? And fourth is let's have good legal planning. And then fifth is, you know, really probably the biggest expense that you're going to face is tax. And so how do we get super efficient? You know, is it possible for us to cut our tax bill in half? And if so, we want to do that, capture those resources and redeploy them into our growth. You know, I don't know how far back you want me to go about why we do it, but, you know, my grandfather started a construction company in 1950. And, you know, he was like that World War II generation, had probably an eighth grade education, I think. And what people from that generation did was just, it's like a totally different breed of human. You're like, wow, that was amazing. So he built this company, and then my dad took over and ran his electrical contracting. And so I grew up in that, you know, manual labor, blue collar, you know, kind of like, I guess, millionaire next door household. And my little brother took it over. He runs it now. And I wasn't as fired up about construction. And I like finance more than construction. So, you know, I guess the way we look at what we do now is more financial engineering. But growing up in that household and hearing, okay, here's a guy that is probably more successful than 99% of the population, maybe even 99% of the world. I don't know. But it doesn't look like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. You know, it doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. And hearing the things that frustrated him and my family, my parents, and them kind of talking about how, you know, the really rich or the really wealthy or the really whatever probably, you know, don't have to do this or no way around that. And this sort of mantra that like, oh, the really wealthy, the really rich, the really whatever, like sort of know something we don't know. And it's preventing us from being able to kind of reach another level. And so I think the journey I've been on is sort of identifying, finding what are those things, strategies, ideas, tools that really wealthy, really successful people use. And how do I bring that down to, you know, sort of this like no-name successful entrepreneur that, you know, they're not in the headlines, they're not on TV, they're probably not in, you know, they're not famous, but they're really successful and they really want help. And in our society, it's really tough because I think there's really an epidemic around financial illiteracy, like a lack of sheer lack of financial education. You don't learn it in school. You don't learn it really the way I think you learn it. There's really one of two ways I see most people learn it. Either you're super lucky and your parents were good with money and they sort of taught you about money. That was my situation, and I realize I'm extremely fortunate for that. The other way that seems like what most entrepreneurs have to go through is this just trial and error, hard knocks of like, well, I'm just making a bunch of mistakes and hopefully I, you know, win more than I lose and I end up ahead at the end of the day. And that's just really frustrating to me. And so I want to help people and empower them, give them things that can help them. And specifically, if we help entrepreneurs, it's like a trickle-down effect. You know, it's not practical for us to think we can really one-on-one help every single human. But so if we go and we say, hey, some family, they're running a company and it has 100 people in it. Well, what we hope or what we believe or want to believe is that if we can make a real big positive impact at the top of that company, you know, like say like you cut the tax bill in half and you freed up all those resources. The hope is that that person that built that organization is going to use those resources and the impact they're going to have by having those additional resources available is going to have sort of this ripple effect, this compound effect. And so it feels like we're able to make a bigger impact than just the number of families we serve.
Man, that's so powerful. Even you highlighting just the reality that financial literacy, like the fundamentals, the basics of financial literacy isn't taught today. Like, I think there's no one listening to this that disagrees with that, right? But then even to go one step beyond that, we're not even teaching the fundamentals, much less teaching about how to properly steward and manage wealth. And that's a whole nother echelon of this topic. Yeah. And so I'm so interested to hear your perspective throughout this conversation, because you get a front row seat to people probably like we do. It's like, it's, in some cases, some of them are accidental CEOs. They're like, holy cow, this thing, I thought it was going to be successful. I had no clue how successful it was going to be. And they find themselves in a position of wealth and ill-equipped to manage it. I'd love to know, just kind of as we start to dive into the topic, are there any common either limiting lies that you see in those people or misconceptions about the topic of wealth that you see pervasive today in the conversations that you have?
Yeah, that's a big question. So I'll get started on it, but you might have to help us peel the onion there. But I love analogies. So let's just roll with the analogy of this, like a front row seat. And so I think what we have is not really the front row seat. You know, if I think about a stage, I think we have more of like a backstage pass. And Have you ever been backstage or behind the scenes?
Yeah, I have. It's a longer story, but I was backstage on the Jimmy Kimmel show with Lady Gaga back there. It's a very long story, but yes, I have been backstage.
So how would you compare, you know, if you think about the audience view, whether you're front row or back, and just like if you're just sitting in that chair and you're just looking at the stage, the presence, the visual, the setup, how would you compare that, the audience view, to maybe what it looks like behind the scenes? What does it look like back
there? Yeah, man, I appreciate this question, and I appreciate where I think you're going with this analogy. Obviously, front row seat, the thing is buttoned, it's polished, like it's a production. Everything happens on time in a specific way, and like it seems like they've done this thing a billion times. It has been my experience. Backstage, in this particular way, it's like there was still a level of organization, but it looked a lot more maybe vulnerable, quite frankly. It looked a lot more like chaotic and disorganized, and maybe people were a little bit more prone to raise their voices or like get a little bit frustrated and irritated and upset. And there were definitely fewer smiles backstage than there were front stage, would be my just off-the-cuff observations.
Yeah, I totally agree. And then let's take that another level. And what about the physical appearance behind the scenes? When you're back in those rooms and corridors behind the stage, what does the physical aesthetic appearance look like back there?
Oh, yeah. So you're not talking of the people. You're talking of just the scene that you're in, correct?
Yeah, both. Both. Yeah, you kind of talk about the people, but what about the scene? What does the scene look like back there?
Yeah, I mean, dark. Right. It's certainly nothing sexy, nothing flashy. There's nothing to write home about. It kind of looks like a warehouse, basically, that you're operating in.
Yeah. It's wild, right? Because when you have this front row seat, everything, like you said, is like polished, cleaned and decorated and all this stuff. And you go like through that service door or whatever, employees only door or whatever. And you're like, I feel like I just walked into some industrial warehouse. Like, what is like the walls are just like white, and there's like, you know, metal chairs, and you know, you're like, they're like out there would look pretty nice and fancy. I mean, it's like if you're at a 5-star hotel, you know, like you've probably seen this if you're speaking at a conference room at a hotel, and oh, we're at this fancy 5-star place, and everything's like fancy and done up, right? And then you go like through like the service entrance to walk around to get behind the stage, and you're like, there's like tables stacked up, and it's just ugly and boring and like nothing that makes you, like you said, want to write home about. And so I think our view with the clients is more like that. It's like the backstage pass. It's not the front row seat to what everyone else sees. And so to your question sort of about like myths and I don't know, like mystery, is that, you know, it's probably a lot more boring back there than you would realize. And I was talking about this with somebody recently, but it makes me think of this conversation because in our society, it's like the boring stuff, we sort of have this psychology that if it's boring, it's like we don't want it. And so we're always sort of looking for this like exciting thing, this exotic thing, this like unique thing. You know, I love things that are unique. But what I have seen with, especially with generational wealth, is that they do a lot of really boring things. And they embrace that and they go, you know what? Like this boring stuff that we're going to nail it down, the blocking and tackling and the basics, and we're going to camp out here and we're going to make sure that all the boring stuff is dialed in. That seems to be what creates more of that long-term wealth. That's what it looks like when you're creating a legacy and impact. It's not, I'm out there gambling with exotic, exciting, unique things that might make me feel like somehow I'm going to skip ahead, you know? It's like, that's not the deal. It's more like the Buffett saying of, you know, the problem is people don't like to get rich slowly. And, you know, You look at, you know, he's been pretty transparent about the compound effect of his net worth. And, you know, there's all these statistics of, oh, he made more in the last 5 years than the prior, like 70 or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of how it works.
It's kind of interesting to see that play out right now in real time. Are you much of a college football fan? Do you follow college football very much, Jeff?
So I went to Texas A&M and I'm trying to provide some emotional distance so that I don't get wrapped up. You know, for those of you out there that went there, you know, we're just a glutton for punishment.
Yes, it's a rough time to be an A&M fan. I went to the University of Texas, but it would probably be better for both of us if we didn't get into that distinction too much.
You know,
right
at least
now.
You didn't hang on to Charlie Strong like we hung on to Jimbo Fisher, you know what I'm saying?
That's right. $100 million mistake. Pretty wild.
You know what I want in life, in my financial life, Alex? I want somebody to come along and offer me a Jimbo contract. Yeah. Here's $100 million, and it doesn't really matter what you do. And now that we're on this topic, I'll tell everybody my theory. I think this is the only logical explanation I can come up with. Is that Jimbo Fisher, maybe his wife was upset and they were talking about it. And she was like, hey, I'm fed up. We don't need this. And she's probably telling him to quit. And he's like, well, if I quit, then I don't get the payout. Like, that's one of the things. So, like, they have to basically fire me. And so then they probably were, you know, I don't know, watching something, maybe on social media, maybe on TV. And they came across this concept of quiet quitting. And then he went back in and was like, yeah, that's it. That's the ticket. He's like, I'm going to do quiet quitting. And so he went in there until they figured it out. And they're like, I think you quit, but you're still on payroll. So like, you're going to have to go.
And he's that's like, right.
That's the only rationale I can come up with.
Most publicized version of quiet quitting that there's been yet. I love it. It seems like you've thought about it just a little bit, Jeff. That's hilarious.
I have to compartmentalize it somehow, you know.
That's right. The reason why I got into college football is because it's super interesting that college football right now is this area where, I mean, golly, 18-year-old kids are building wealth suddenly. And one of the things that I was listening to.
I got to pause you there. Building wealth, I don't know. Getting paid? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a super good distinction. That's actually something that's related to what I was going to say is I was listening to something. They were talking about how because that's going on with NIL deals and all of that, at the same time that everything is developing with the transfer portal, they said that they're starting to see this trend where kids right out of high school will go to the place that offers them the Ferrari and the flashy deal. And it's just like glamorous and big and exciting. And then a lot of times what's happening right now is that stuff wears off after about 2 years. And then a school like Missouri comes in and says, we can't offer you the Ferrari and we're not going to. But what we can do is we can develop you to be a better football player. We can get you a good education. And if you're willing to do the work that it takes, we're going to put you in a position to be in the NFL. And if you're not in the NFL, you're going to go live a good life. And they're saying that lots of kids are grabbing onto that offer. But it kind of sounds like the distinction that you're talking about where it's like we think wealth is flashy, exciting, glamorous Ferrari. And what it really is the X's and O's, the daily grind, the boring stuff that you just commit yourself to. Does that feel right?
Yeah. I mean, write this down, okay? Commit this to memory. Rich people have income. Wealthy people have assets. So somebody came to me recently, and I guess they had a connection or something. They're like, Jeff, I'm going to help you get into the college NIL scene. You can work with these athletes. I go, no way, dude. I was like, you think that a good client for me is an 18-year-old who just went from being broke to like having $1 million and that they're going to want to sit down with me and have like mature, logical, thought out financial decisions? No. They're going to like charter a jet to go rent some giant mansion and throw a mega party and live it up. Like, and I don't want to be their parent trying to tell them not to do that and to put it over here and save it for later. Like, no thanks. I'm not, you know, hire a psychologist or something to work on that. It's not my department.
Yeah. So explain the difference for people in layman's terms, when you think of the difference between an income stream and an asset, like how do you think about the difference between those two things?
Yeah. Well, so our audience here is mostly entrepreneurs, right? And people that are running businesses, created businesses. And I'll tell you, over the years of being backstage with those folks and seeing the parts that most people never see, what I have found is that if I sort of try to take all of the goals and desires and priorities and things that they say when they hire us, and if I try to somehow find like this thread, this through line that says, okay, this is sort of what connects it all, it would be this. It would be that they want to cross this freedom threshold. And that freedom threshold happens when you cross that, is when you get to a place where you realize, I no longer have to depend on my labor. I don't have to, you know, I'm not trading time for money. It's not about my earned income anymore. It's not about living on my P&L anymore. I have gotten to this place to where my balance sheet can, if I want it to and I need it to, it can support me and sustain me. And crossing that threshold is a very significant change. And on the side of the threshold before crossing it, what I find is that most entrepreneurs, like 90%+ of their net worth is in their business and maybe some real estate. And the challenge with that is we know as entrepreneurs all of the ways that our business that is theoretically worth something, we haven't cashed it in yet, we know the things that could blow it all up and make it go away and make it go to nothing tomorrow. And we're like, oh my gosh, if this domino effect happens, game over. And so what we all sort of want as entrepreneurs is we want to sort of, it's really interesting. You know, we have some mutual friends and I've talked to them about this before too, because it's really interesting. Most entrepreneurs, especially the ones that are successful, okay, you're making $1 million a year of profit. I'm not talking revenue. You know, you're really getting somewhere. You're making several million of profit. They want to go and somehow create an income stream that is not their business. And I think if we start to really unpack that, it's because of that sort of, maybe we categorize it as fear, but it's really just that knowledge of this business that I have that's sort of worth something could go away. And so what I think they're really saying when they say, I want to create an income stream that's not this business, what they're really saying is I want to have an income stream that can't go away, that won't go away. And the thing that requires entrepreneurs to have so much courage to get there is they have to sort of embrace this possible failure in their enterprise, just grow it and scale it and then somehow liquidate it and hope that they can keep it all together to get to where then they can put it into more like, say, passive assets or assets that can sustain them. And so, you know, people want to just say, okay, how do I get across that threshold? Because when I cross it, the whole game changes. Like when you live on your balance sheet, a lot of people hire us for tax planning, okay? When you're living on your balance sheet, taxes are basically optional, okay? Like you don't, I'll give you an example. Let's just say you had a bunch of real estate, okay? Your real estate's worth $100 million. It went up 10% this year. Now it's 110, and you need $1 million for your lifestyle. Guess what? You can just go borrow some money against your real estate. You know how much tax you pay on that borrowed money? Zero. Okay, cool. You just paid for your lifestyle, zero tax money. I mean, I'm not saying that's how you need to do it. I'm just saying you could if you wanted to. So getting to your balance sheet also puts you in a place of low need once you're on the other side of that threshold. Mm-hmm. Because once you cross that threshold, you go, I don't necessarily feel a sense of need like I do before crossing. Before crossing that threshold, I feel like, well, geez, I need this to work. I mean, I need this podcast to make people like me, or I need them to, you know, this is going to drive me a bunch of business, or I need this, or my gosh, this thing better work, or I need that client to stick around, or I need whatever, and I need this, and I need this, and I need to make all this work. And it's exhausting. And it causes us to approach business and the relationships with low power. And when we cross that threshold, our need goes way down. And we're like, oh, I don't need that client. I mean, I guess I could work for them if it feels right, you know? And then that low need gives us this sense of high power that we can approach business and relationships with. And so I think that's a huge deal when you think about income versus assets. And, you know, what happens with rich people that have income, you can have this increasing income and have this increasing lifestyle that follows it, and you're not going to ever get anywhere. You're just living paycheck to paycheck. You know, sometimes people ask me, like, or I'll just go off on this tangent of what broke entrepreneurs say. And one of the ones, somebody asked me the other day, hey, tell me one of those things. And along these lines, what it made me think of is telltale sign for me of a broke entrepreneur is I don't have any liquidity because I reinvested all in my business. I'm not saying that it's always 100% of the time true. It's just been true every time somebody's told that to me. Okay. So why is that? You go, okay, so you don't have any liquidity. You're saying it's because of this. And what I've learned is that people have two reasons for doing something. One that sounds good and the real one. Well, let's just say you had all that money and you gave it to me. You said, Jeff, I want your firm to manage this millions of dollars for me. Okay. And then I said, you know what? We're not going to have a plan. We're not going to do review meetings. We're not going to do performance reporting. We're just going to throw it out there. We'll just see what happens. Okay. What does that look like in your business? Because you wouldn't tolerate that from me. So is that what investing in your business looks like? Because what would really investing in your business look like? Really investing in your business would look like, I'm accumulating capital. I'm accumulating at a consistent rate. I'm predicting when I'm going to have X amount of capital. Okay, now I have $1 million of capital. And here are the different ways that we could invest that in our business. And this is the diligence process that we went through to determine which strategic investments we were going to make and at what size we were going to make them. And then we sat there and determined timeframes and KPIs and metrics for how we were going to measure success and performance over time. And then we had regular cadence review meetings to study it and say, are we on track? Are we not on track? Do we pull the plug? Do we keep going? And how do we know if we succeeded or failed? That's what investing in your business would look like. But every time somebody tells me they don't have liquidity because they're reinvesting in their business, and I say, well, show me that plan, show me those performance reports, show me those reports, you know, they don't have it.
So it seems like what you're highlighting there is, like, as it relates to our business, we're way too casual with the way that we use the word investing. And it's like the word investing implies all of that reporting, all of that data, systematized rhythms of evaluation, all with the expectation of, like, investments create a return. Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah. Like, okay, here's the desired outcome. Here's the time frame. Here's how we're going to measure it. Here's all these things. This is when we're going to review it. This is how we're going to report on it. This is how we're going to track it, right? That's what investing looks like.
Okay. I love that you call it the freedom threshold too. And it's interesting that the way you communicate about it, you're really talking about it as like a line. Like, you cross over this line and you experience it. And before that line, you don't. What is it that people are experiencing before that line? Like, what are the emotions associated with that? What does their day-to-day look like before that, before they encounter that, what you call the freedom threshold?
You know, I don't think all of us are the same. I don't think all humans are the same. And so the way that people handle that is probably different. You know, you have people with more of like a daredevil personality, and they probably are just like, you know, free spirited, and they're like, what? Like, it's, you know, whatever. And they're going to go big or go home, and they're not worried about it. You know, what I find though, that most entrepreneurs, you know, sort of their deepest thoughts are really around, I know how this thing can blow up, and I don't want to be in a position where I feel like I built something and it could create a legacy or an impact, or it could enrich my family or my community and philanthropy. And then somehow those dominoes fell and it all just went away.
Mm. So almost like thinking through the lens of worst case scenario and like that's defining their entire strategy. Does that feel like what you're saying?
I don't know that that should define your entire strategy, but it did make me think though that if we got a group of your audience in a room and played a game of what if worst case scenario with each other, I think with a group of entrepreneurs, it could probably get real dark.
No kidding. And pretty creative really quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think somehow we're all a little bit afraid that we won't have what we need to live, you know, and it doesn't mean that it's realistic. You know, I mean, I have these conversations with my wife and you know, something doesn't go the way I think it should go. And it gets me going down this negative rabbit hole. And she's like, oh, how bad is it? I'm like, I don't know. It could be really bad. She's like, oh yeah, tell me about it. Are we going to be, you know, living under a bridge? And I'm like, maybe, you know? And she's like, oh, really? You think so? You know? And she's much more realistic. And so she unpacks it for me. She's like, I think we're okay because you don't really even need to work. You're just doing it because you want to, remember? And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. It just kind of snaps me out of it, you know? But, you know, I think there's more of us out there that have those thoughts occasionally than, mm-hmm. and that's the stuff, that's the mess that you see backstage.
Mm. Jeff, there's something that I'm thinking about that I'm not entirely even sure how to ask this question, but it's something that I just would like to hear you speak to is sometimes it seems like as it relates to topics like increasing amounts of freedom, creating your business into an asset that's able to operate independent of you, gaining greater and greater amounts of wealth that you aren't necessarily investing hours of your time to create or that aren't tied to your hours of time. I think one of the things that often blocks people from even pursuing those outcomes is maybe a sense of shame or guilt surrounding the idea of wealth. And maybe people are experiencing wealth, but they weren't raised in an environment where that was ever a reality, or maybe they were even raised in an environment where they lived in the opposite of that reality. And they don't necessarily know how to handle it properly or how to handle it in a healthy way. I'd love just to know, have you experienced that in people you talk to? And what are the thoughts you have around that kind of line of thinking, Jeff?
Well, I mean, I would say that most of the people that we work for are like first generation to have the kind of wealth that they have. Most of them are probably the wealthiest person in their family and maybe the wealthiest person to have ever been in their family. Maybe they have a new friend circle, but they're probably wealthier than their old friend circle or friends from back in the day kind of circle. And it's really tough because we don't, like, as a society, publicize what goes on in those service corridors behind the scenes backstage. And because of that, people are just, they just judge the books by the cover. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard because, you know, back to like how it's not, this stuff isn't taught in school, and maybe you're fortunate enough that you have parents that were capable and actually taught you, but it's really hard because I think a lot of our clients sit with this feeling, probably like my family felt, like there's got to be a better way to go about this. But we don't, as a society, have like real, transparent, vulnerable conversation about that part of our life and tactically, mechanically, like this is what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, right? And so it's kind of a, probably more a feeling of like they're in the wilderness alone, you know, like I'm out here blazing a trail. And it's just me versus everything. And I'm just trying to figure it all out. And I don't know where to go. I don't have people that are maybe running on the same track that we can, you know, brainstorm and share ideas with. And so I think it's probably more a feeling of just going, I don't have any clue what to do with what I've created, you know?
Mm. And then I think we, if we're not careful, people in general do this, and I would imagine this is true. It's certainly true with the one-on-one customers that we work with that would fit into this category. We start to say, well, who am I to complain about this? I don't have a clue. I don't know how to manage this asset. But like what I'm really talking about here is that I've got millions of dollars that I don't know what to do with. And we diminish the actual challenge. But it sounds like what you're saying is like, it's a huge challenge that has ramifications for their future, but also like they're wearing the weight of responsibility of generations that are going to be affected by the decisions that they make. And so it's probably not right to diminish the power of those problems in your life. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's hard. And, you know, the way that the system is set up, at least in our country, is that the more money you have and the more money that you make, the more options are available to you. And quite frankly, the options are better. And, you know, so I think when people feel like maybe that system is unfair, it's like, okay, well, you know, back to why I do this, like I didn't create that system to be like that in our country. But if I can take it, what I learn about what do people do at the highest levels and bring it down to sort of the local successful people in the community and help them and say, hey, let me share with you what's around the corner. Because I think most of them just really want to know, like they probably have, you know, questions about, I don't know what I don't know. I don't feel like I have all this figured out, you know, and I don't know where to go to figure it out. I don't know who to talk to. Maybe along the lines of what you're saying, I don't know that I see it as like shame, but maybe almost like this imposter syndrome of like feeling like an imposter in that scenario. And it gets real weird. You know, these are all good problems to have. I would trade these problems for most other problems, but you know, you end up in awkward scenarios because like I'm thinking of one of my friends and he's been super successful and he likes having a nice supercar. And so he's got this amazing car. I'm not a car guy, but whatever. It's some super awesome car, right? And then he also has a Ford Escape. like green or something. You
know? Okay, which one does he drive and which one does his wife drive? Because that might not go too well.
He drives both of them. So like when he feels like he's going to be judged, he drives the Ford Escape. Because he's like, as much as he loves driving that fancy supercar, he's like, people are just going to think I'm in this jerk, I'm this a-hole, I'm this whatever, you know. It's going to cause people to like have these, you know, thoughts about me. And so if he feels that, then he just drives the Ford Escape, you know, and leaves the other one in the garage. And I think that's kind of unfortunate, but you know, it just kind of speaks to how, I guess it's very isolating, makes you feel very alone.
You know? Well, and maybe feel bad for the results that you're experiencing. You telling that story made me think of, I knew a business owner once that literally commented on the fact that he has a really fancy Escalade and he lives in a city and he will literally hide if he sees someone walking by, if he's sitting in his car on a phone call or something, he'll lower his head. And so like how do you counsel that person? Or is there anything you have for us on even your mindset on like, why is wealth not something we need to apologize for or hide or feel bad about? Like, what is the proper way to think about it?
So, you know, I think most of your community following here has some degree of faith in their life, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if you really want to master money and you really want to master wealth, and you want a really good antidote to what we're talking about, you want something that will counteract that, I think it's found in your charity. It's found in your philanthropy. Because when you think about money, if you think like, okay, I've got this like tight grip on money because I still have that like sense of need. I need this. Like I need, like I'm going to be broke. I'm going to be under that bridge if I don't have it. So I'm grasping on as tight as I can, right? Well, okay, well, maybe the money won't go out of your hands, but it's also really hard for anything to get in there. And when you have this like open hand approach and you go, I can freely give and I can freely receive, and you subscribe into that abundance mentality, and you realize that I think the clients that we have that have the most success, the most peace, the most joy are also the most charitable. Hmm. And the ability to freely give away the resource that you have gone through this crazy superhuman effort to birth the business into existence and get it to produce at a high level, and everything that that entail, and the fruit of that, be able to just freely give it away, I think psychologically allows you to elevate to a totally different level with money. And then that perhaps will alleviate some of that sense of guilt. Because you're like, no, I'm doing good with this money. And you can probably get to a place where you can say, if you judge me because of the house I live in or the car I drive or something, that's more something for you to work out than for me to be concerned. You know? But I would challenge everyone listening, if you don't currently give, you know, it's interesting. Almost every client we have, I ask them, do you have charitable goals? And usually I get one of two responses. It's either yes, and here's what they are, or it's, well, we would like to later when we have more, right? Mm. And I think for most entrepreneurs, the question of when is enough? When is enough enough? I think entrepreneurs, most especially really successful ones, are probably wired where we weren't born with that switch. And so it's probably never going to be enough. So if you realize that it's never going to be enough, then you need some other outlet other than just accumulation. Like, you have to go, like, at some point, why are you doing this? What is your legacy going to be? What is your impact going to be? You know? And I think if you can find those causes to support in a big way, in my experience, I just think when you give, I don't know, it's not a science, but the more I push myself to give, the more I seem to receive. Mm. It's like, you can't outgive God. You just can't. So, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but
I love that. I heard a pastor recently, he was reflecting on that verse, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And he took that verse in a way I'd never thought about it before. He said that one of the good applications of that verse is that if I want my heart to go towards something, I just put my money in it. Right. And he said, because if I put my treasure into, like you're talking about, causes, charities, things for the good of the community, my heart will follow that. And I thought that was such a powerful, practical application of, like, where our treasure is, there our heart will go also. Yeah. Jeff, I wasn't planning on doing this before we entered into this conversation, but I think the way you just wrapped that up with generosity was so good. What I think I'd like to do is I'd like to make this part one, because I think we so, like, in such a really helpful way, captured the mindset and motivations behind wealth building. And then you and I will just stay on and we'll record part two. We'll just release it a week later. And I think part two will make really, I know you're really practical content on the five pillars of wealth building. And we'll jump into what those pillars are and how they work. So before we end part one, if you're down for this game plan, are you down for this game plan?
That works for me.
Killer. I love it. So before we end part one, if people kind of are finding themselves in the category of, like, man, I'm actually really interested in what Jeff and his team do, and I might be interested in working with them in some capacity, where can they find out more information about y'all?
Yeah. So I send most people to a place, just go to talktaxwithjeff.com. You know, and the reason why we start there is tax is probably your biggest expense. And if we cut that bill in half, what can you do with that? You know, what impact does that make? How many years does that shave off of you crossing your threshold? Or how much more does that amplify and scale your legacy and impact?
Very cool. We'll put the link to that in the show notes of this episode. Thanks on behalf of the whole audience for your time talking about the mindset and motives behind building wealth. Appreciate you.
Well, I'm grateful to Jeff for his time, for his energy, and for his passion on this topic. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast so that you get part two of this conversation whenever we release it next week. And also, please take time, if you haven't already, to rate and review the podcast. I read those reviews, and they're really helpful for me as we start to plan future conversations and future content, because we like to know what y'all like, what is helpful, and what is valuable. Well, y'all know this. We're rooting for you. We're praying for you. We want to see you win. Remember, my strength is not for me. Your strength is not for you. Our strength is for service. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go.